Hello and welcome to the Sound Talk podcast. I'm Stephen Kerrison and I run Tall Trees Audio Mastering here in Liverpool.
Hello, I'm also from Liverpool. I'm also called Stephen and I'm from what studio?
Sound Talk is a podcast where each episode we, the Stevens, as we've probably regretfully dubbed ourselves, will be chatting to a special guest who we respect and admire about their journey into audio, their approach and working practices and all things to do with sound. Today's guest is Annie Gardner. Annie is perhaps best known for her work in her long-running bass and drums duo Hysterical Injury, who were last seen up and down the country on tour with Beak, but that's only a small part of what she does. As well as currently playing bass for instrumental rock trio Olanza, she's also a music tutor, songwriter for hire,
yeah,
solo artist,
yeah,
recording engineer.
Wow, yeah.
Anything else?
Oh, I don't know. Mother.
Mother,
partner, dog lover.
Perfect.
All that kind of stuff.
We'll get to that. So thanks so much for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Wow, it makes me sound proper. Such a nice introduction there. Yeah. It's very nice.
So funny. Where are you right now, Annie?
I'm in Easton in Bristol, sat in my little studio, which you can't see because it's an absolute mess. Because the bulk of my work is actually where I'm sat, with this mic and my preamp, and I've got lyric sheets up there and all that kind of thing, and a music stand with lyrics and stuff there. So I do most of my work in this little space. So that's where I am right now.
Could you just talk us through what you're actually sort of doing right now? What are the different things that you're doing right now?
Well, that's good you asked that. And I've got a nice list of post-it notes right in front of me of all the things I'm working on and remembering to do every day. So first and foremost, I am working at finishing, and now it's going to the vinyl plant and everything, my first solo album under my own name, which is quite different to Hysterical Injury because it's acoustic, nylon string guitar and vocals and cello bass, upright bass and violin. So I'm obviously you mastered that, Steve, so that's the one thing that I'm sort of really working on doing now, because even though the music and all that stuff is finished and I'm getting it off to the vinyl plant, I'm currently illustrating a lyric book to go with it, and it's sort of turning into quite a, I mean, I've always wanted to make some kind of graphic novel, so every morning I'm sort of doing drawings and working on this lyric book for that to go with it, so that's a big thing at the moment. I am also working I work as a senior lecturer in songwriting at BIM Bristol, and I've just taken a little step back at the time that I spend there. It was 4 days a week in the last semester, but I've taken it back to one, just so I can get more creative projects done. It's quite hard to balance all that. So I sort of did the maths and thought, well, actually, you know, it's rare you get this kind of time where it's sort of undisrupted or undistracted in lockdown, you know, let's try and make the most of that. And I can just about afford to sort of, make that minimum and concentrate. So, but on Mondays, what I do there is I run a creative processes module for second year songwriters, which is so exciting and so much fun. We do that online. We have done all year. So we went into it online and sort of we've really got to grips with how to use Zoom in a creative way to get the people doing the work in the room, and me bringing in techniques and ideas and trying and testing and talking, discussing and that kind of thing. It's been really brilliant. But I also run an improvisation module I have done at BIM called Musical Responses and Collaborative Experiments.
Sweet.
And had done that for the last 5 years with a good, very good friend of mine and former student of mine, Dan Johnson. We've been doing that for 5 years. And then, of course, when that went online, my goodness, how on earth do we group improvise over the internet? So we've been developing techniques of how to do that. And that's been a lot of fun as well. So I do that on Monday. I won't go too far into that at the moment because it's a huge subject. And what we've discovered through doing it is incredible. it just sounds like too much stuff. And then I've got various sort of vocal people ask me to sing on their stuff. So that's kind of nice. It's always a surprise when people ask me to do that. But that comes in more often than I imagine it does. I'm always surprised every time someone asks me, but then, oh, I've got someone who's asked me to sing again, and that's nice. So I've got a few of those happening, and then a few songs to sort of finish off for people. And all that kind of stuff. So, and of course the Alanza album, we've been working hard on that. That's a new album that we were set to record in February, but we obviously can't because everything's shut down. So that's been postponed, but we've got a private space to practice. So we've been able to do that. So we're doing that every week in our bubbles, in our masks and socially distanced. And
so in a nutshell, you're doing tons of stuff.
It everything. Sounds ridiculous, doesn't it, when I reel it all off like that? It's like, I thought I did nothing all day. But yeah, that's what I'm currently working on.
And is all that written down just on post-it notes in front of you?
It is, yeah. Yeah.
That's going to get post-it note heavy. I mean, you've got to have some organisation skills to manage that much stuff. So how are you doing that?
Yeah, with the post-it notes. It's the only thing that works. Otherwise, I just forget.
I've been snooping on your website and I saw that you've recorded in some really, really awesome studios in Bristol. And I noticed that you've even recorded with people like Jim Barr, the chap from the band Get the Blessing, etc. Could you talk a little bit about some of those studios, perhaps?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Working with Jim has been fantastic and quite long-standing now. When we did our first album, we recorded in Jim's studio, which is just down the road from where I live now in Easton, J&J. And we recorded there with James King, who was one of his engineers there at the time. I think it was his main engineer other than him. And so we did that with James, and Jim was there. You know, he comes in and he's really friendly, and he just sort of came in and met us all and oh, how's it going? And he's really interested, and we started talking about pedals. And I was quite blown away, really, because I was a huge Portishead fan when I was a teenager. And I think Beth Gibbons is one of my biggest sort of vocal inspirations. You can probably hear that, and I don't want to wear it on my sleeve. I'd say Bjork maybe is as well, but it she really did capture me. So to meet Jim, who plays bass for them, I was a bit starstruck for a while. But when we started to talk about pedals and stuff, it's like, oh, bass, you know, bass is the place. you know, so that was really good. And he just, you know, he's just very nice. He was interested and kept in touch. We sent him the album and he loved it. And then we went back in there when we were doing our next recording. And we had the opportunity this time to work with the Strokes producer, Gordon Raphael, who I had met because I was doing all the masterclasses at BIM Bristol at the time. We have quite a great selection of guests that would come in and do a masterclass with the kids. But it sounds sort of easy, but actually what I had to do was present interviews and prepare interviews for them. Quite often they were filmed and they were sort of an hour and a half, 2 hours. And that's how I first sort of met Gordon. And he liked the EP, and he had some friends here in Bristol, and he was over again, and he came back to BIM, and then we met him again. And then he was like, oh, you know what? I really want to produce you. And And I said, well, I know this just the studio. So we went back to Jim's. And Jim was really excited to meet Gordon. And it all went like that. And Jim sort of helped out a little bit there. So then I bumped into Jim a few years later, just when we were starting to write this album, or we had it ready to go. And he said, you know what? I'd really want to produce your next album. And I said, well, absolutely. And then that's what we did. We did a series of, I think it was 4 day or 2 day sessions. Something like that. We just went in, recorded, because we were writing them at the same time. So we'd write 4, then go in and record them. We'd write 4, go and record them. Write 4, go and record them. We chose the best, and then Jim and I mixed that together. And he's got such a great bass sound on the Get the Blessing stuff. And we'd supported them as well in Bristol. And it's a very similar bass sound to what I was kind of looking for. And I think I always struggled with getting the bass sound onto our recordings in the way I really wanted it to. Because it's quite encompassing live. I kind of like, you know, it's a big... big sound, and that happened because we used to be a 3-piece and the guitarist left, and he was such a noisy guitarist that it was like, oh my goodness, how are we gonna fill that sound? But before that, I'd never used a pedal in my life, so I just got the Fuzz Factory, the Zvex Fuzz Factory that our guitarist had, and put it on my bass and got 2 amps. And going, oh my God, like that. And I just thought, yeah, that's a winner, because I don't know what this pedal's doing. And that was part of it, that errant sound, that uncontrollable kind of, was so exhilarating.
What amp were you using? What amp were you driving a bass through a Buzz Factory with? I feel really sorry for it.
I know. Well, actually, I was extremely lucky to inherit from my dad a old 1969 Ampeg Gemini Twin combo.
Wow.
Which is also completely errant. It's only 65 watts, and if I turn it up more than 2, forget it. And it's like that in any venue I've played. It's nuts. It's a beautiful thing. It's just there. I can see it. Hello, amp. Yeah, it's a wonderful thing.
I was going to say, did Jim record your new record? The solo record that you were mentioning earlier?
No, my new solo record, I recorded that myself. And the cellos, and upright bass and violin were all recorded in the remote spaces of the players. And they just sent it in and I put it together here.
Yeah. That's incredible. I mean, having heard that record, it really sounds really I think I used the word homespun, and I didn't mean that in like it sounds crap. I mean, it sounds really kind of it sounds like you're sitting in a really cozy living room all playing it together.
Oh, that's lovely. That's lovely to hear, because I think I was definitely aiming for that sound, that folky. Well, I mean, one of the albums that really inspired me in 2019 was the Lancome album. I don't know if you've heard that Irish band. Gosh, a lot of the songs on that album are Irish traditional folk songs, but they've got one or two of their own, and it's just it's folk music, but it's heavy and it's dark, and they've got the dirt in there, and I just thought, woof. You know, that's for me, that's folk that hits me in the heart, you know. You don't have to be loud and ridiculous like Hysterical Injury to get to that weight and that emotional heaviness, and that's really what I wanted to achieve with the new album, was that sort of dirt and the dirtiness and the beauty of what acoustic instruments can do. Yeah, I recorded that one here.
And have you always done your own demos at home?
Yes, or in a rehearsal room. with my brother, always on phone recordings. My brother used to have, in his living room, he had the electric kit set up. And I mean, most of the historical injury practices, you won't believe, were done on headphones. And all the writing.
Sometimes you have to do that, don't you?
Yeah.
So, play to clicks?
No, we never play to clicks, no. But we'd just have logic. We'd have logic on a laptop. Tom would have his electric kit going in there. I just have my bass going into the and the vocal going into the interface through my pedal board. And I'd have to do a bit of metering. And I actually would cut out the Zvex on that loop because it would just kill the interface. But got the rest of it in because I had a big muff as well because I had the things going to two amplifiers had one signal chain going to one and then the Zvex had its own amp. I knew that the distortion bits where that would come in and out. But yeah, that was all of our stuff pretty much was written that way on headphones quietly in a room in Bristol, in a living room. Yeah,
it's the beauty of electric drums as well, I suppose. It cuts out all the hell of mics on in rooms and things like that.
Well, one of the things I did notice was how much more work we could get done when the volume was right down.
It takes a long time to realise, doesn't it? I'm a drummer, so unfortunately drummers sit round just hitting things and getting in the way. And thankfully I do other things, but if I'm on the kit, I just want to play. And if you've got a drummer in the room, they probably want to play.
Yeah. Of course.
And there's something about being able to actually turn down a drum kit, which is remarkably useful.
Oh, yeah. And actually, we the stuff we did with Gordon and the stuff we did on our last album, Life, Death, Life, that we wrote all of that with the volume down. And you know, the fatigue was much less. We could go for longer. We could routine things. We could go over and over and over things intricately, part writing and all that sort of thing. It was much, much easier. We sort of wondered why on earth we had never done that before. You know.
It's very difficult to concentrate on detail when you're playing, like, gig levels. Yeah. I've found that. An old band of mine used to, like, practicing to a click track, which we practice, you do the rehearsals to a click track, and then after however many goes, we take the click track off so that we kind of at least knew where we were. But we hadn't cottoned on to the fact that you could do that quietly. So we just had a click track going through the PA, super loud, like louder than the band, so we could all hear it.
Metal bands love doing that, yeah.
It's just, it's horrible.
There's always a metal band somewhere next door doing it, isn't there? Someone practicing the double kick or something, yeah.
Yeah.
Breaks PAs as well, that little noise. So when you are, do you relate like songwriting as a connecting thing to, say, your production? Are they always in tandem?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think certainly when I started to build and learn about how to record myself demoing, I suppose that's how it would start off. When I started to sort of do that myself, the things started to intermingle, and I was certainly looking for... Sound definitely inspires me, put it like that. You know, it definitely, definitely inspires me. I can hear a sound and I just want to write, you know.
Are we talking flick through a preset type vibe of sound, or things you're hearing organically in the world, or?
All of the above, yeah. You know, and I've got clips, endless clips of things I found on walks, you know, that have just made me go, that reminds me of something that's turned into a sample or something. Or, you know, for example, the solo album I'm just about to release, that I was obsessed with the vocal sound, the vocal aesthetic on that second Mazzy Star record, and so I wanted to sort of recreate that so I just sort of picked up the acoustic guitar, smacked on a load of reverb, just, you know, Space Designer in Logic.
What a guy.
Yeah, very useful. 58 taped to the desk, And as I was playing, I was like, oh my God, I don't even care what I'm playing. I just love this sound. And that's how I demoed all of those tracks. Absolutely covered in. I tried to get the reverb
just to the table top. Did you
say? Yeah, because I couldn't. I'm also lazy.
But that solves it. All vibrations have gone. That's great.
I'm also like, if I'm in the, I can't be bothered to sort of like get anything too, because I'm trying to catch that flame, if you like the flame. So quickly onto the desk. That I tried to get the reverb as much as I could near to that reverb that was on the album, and I just started playing, and because of that sound, all of these songs sort of emerged, and I was just like, oh, I love this. I love this sound. So yeah, I mean, that was a really close link to sound production and songwriting, definitely in that instance. And I think when I started to, I kind of see my life in two parts at the moment: pre-baby, post-baby.
What makes you think?
Because my baby is nearly 18 years old, so pre-baby, I had actually quite a lot of work experience in studios, but then baby. And all that came with it, it was quite a few years where I was just a bit lost and also not confident to sort of maybe get work in studios and things. So just sort of worked with what I had at home, which was a cassette four track, and then getting Logic on a computer and started to slowly. But all these things took time, and kind of collecting bits from here and there. So yeah, the sort of writing of the music was definitely synonymous with me demoing at home, you know, trying and failing and trying and failing and trying to make not so great equipment work well. And I think there's a real value in that now, because now I have some good pieces of equipment. It's so much easier with great equipment, but also I have, I guess, that depth of knowledge of being able to apply stuff more easily maybe than if I'd started out that way and had that expectation that I can only do this if I've got this great equipment. But actually,
without a doubt, I think you'll always, like, having limitations forces you to think creatively.
Yeah.
And I think it's one thing that I think is kind of, it's a negative side to everything just being completely available at the moment. Like, I mean, mixing and mastering, like, if you're doing it in the box, everybody's got the same stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so, you know, it's whether you know how to use it is a different matter, but yeah, Everyone's got the same stuff. And I think if you're coming in as a beginner and you're like, right, well, I've got the entire Sound Toys bundle and I've got the entire FabFilter suite and I've got Ableton and I've got Logic, it's surely overwhelming.
Mm. Absolutely, yeah. Where there's so much value about just learning how to put a mic in a room, and my sort of aim was always very simple: can I hear it? You know,
is the thing on? Yeah. Is it green or red?
Not, you know, and trying not to go for any particular style or anything. Can I hear it? Can I hear it next to that sound? Can I hear it next to that sound? Well, yeah. All go then. You know, is it clear? Is it loud? Is, you know, is it peaking? No, fine.
Would you class, like, the self-constraint a thing that you do? Because, say, for instance, the sound designer, the length of that was potentially influencing the length of your space in your music immediately, and as you say, it influences one particular way, but it may influence many others as well. Do you think that's something that you often impose to yourself or prefer to build from, perhaps?
Yeah, probably limitations is something I go on about. I'm a big believer in using what's around you, and I often, when the students go, well, I can't do this because I can't do that because I don't have this, and I just sit there and I glaze over and go, you don't need anything, you've got everything you need in yourself, come on. You know, so I'm a big believer in working with what you've got, and then what does that sound like? You know, what does that sound like? Let's find out, you know, it does, you know, so I think, sound designer has endless possibilities, and And, you know, just like in the very early days of the four-track cassette, just panning something hard left and hard right gave an incredible feeling in your headphones. And the minute you double-track things on a tape, wow, that's another world. It's just, yeah, I love that idea of a world you can create in sound.
What was the jump from analog to digital for you? What was the first go? Logic?
Logic, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I did learn Cubase and stuff when I did AS Music Tech, but I definitely prefer Logic. And it's just, yeah, it's just stuck, you know. Yeah. I mean, they're all as good as each other, I'm sure.
I think they are now, really. Yeah, I think it's whichever one you've landed on, isn't it, really? Mm. Thankfully, which is a good thing, you know.
Yeah. And I use it as a writing tool. I'm a writer that mostly writes in the box. I'm I'll come up with bits, record it, listen back, put things together. You're definitely a writer that uses the box.
Logic's just built for that, isn't it? It's wonderful for that. It really feels like it's laid out that way from the first time you realise, oh, it's got all of the things that I needed.
Yeah. Great. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I used Ableton for a little while, and coming from an organic music background where, you know, guitars and stuff like that, and not from an electronic music background, when I first tried Logic for the first time after using Ableton, it was like, oh, right, this is kind of much more built for me. I mean, they sound exactly the same, but it's just what's presented to you and, you know, how to use it. Because it's just, I still use those things as just, they're just glorified four tracks, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of where I started demoing and applying the knowledge that I'd learned in the studios, I suppose, onto this tiny little four track. And then it was just like, oh, well, I can do that on Logic and I don't run out of tape.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Do you have a favourite plugin other than Space Designer?
Probably the EQ. Channel EQ's my friend.
That's what I always end up saying. You can't not say it, can you? Because you will use it, even if you replace it. You're going to probably put it on everything at one point.
I think EQ's my favourite thing of all time, actually. It's the one thing that remains on everything, even if I've tried a load of things and taken them off, EQ remains. And I was surprised when I, finalised my mixes to send to you for the solo album. You know, I took the compression off. It's just had EQ. Those were the takes as they are, raw, but just EQ. And I thought, God, that's funny. So EQ, I think, is my favourite. And I use channel EQ. I haven't got any special one, simply because it has never broken for me, so I haven't sought another one. So there we go.
I honestly don't think you would need another one, like for basic track, for doing music like you do, where you're tracking organic instruments and stuff like that. I mean, what do you really, what else do you need?
Yeah. And I mean, that goes for the recording, the site recording I've done as well. It's, I try to get the tone right in the room. I was taught when I started work, I started working for a recording studio in South Wales. I'm from South Wales. And, when I was, I don't know, it'd be the late 90s, I was working for Black Mountain Recordings. They had a mobile studio, which they did. They worked with loads of male voice choirs, you know. They're really famous for that.
Good, yeah.
They'd take the mobile out and, they'd, you know, for Radio 3, they'd record all the Welsh male voice choirs. And I did that a few times with them. It was just glorious.
Great
just,
job.
Wow. Yeah. As a sort of tea person and plugging leads in and miking things. And so, yeah, well, I was working for them, and I think what I learned from them, they were installing the studio in an old, it's like an old estate in South Wales, and I learned all kinds of things about desks and tag blocks and soldering and that kind of thing. I actually can't remember what my point was.
it's great vibes though.
about EQ, right? Yes, about EQ. And so the engineer I was working with at the time, who was teaching me how to sort of strip cables and solder and stuff, he said to me, he goes, As long as you get the sound right at the source, then everything else is just to bring it out. And that I never forgot. And it's turned out to be right every time.
Yeah.
Sound advice.
Can't argue with that.
Yeah.
So, sight recording is something that I really want to ask you about, actually. What is or was Toilet Fest?
Oh, Toilet Fest. Toilet Fest, again, one of my very good friends, Dan Johnson, drummer extraordinaire, brilliant creative mind, former student, but now we work together really a lot on the musical responses class. Toilet Fest was a sort of follow-on from Secret Saturdays, which were a series of shows we did presented in rehearsal rooms. They were kind of very underground.
They were literally
underground and completely sort of unsourceable. People would just sort of turn up at midday through a private Facebook, and we'd have bands play, and people would come in and watch, and I recorded things that went on there. So Toilet Fest was sort of a follow-on, but Dan was living in a place in Bristol at the time where he had this really long bathroom, and because it was such a small space, he did all of his practicing on his drums in this toilet. So he had a shower, then his drums set up, then the toilet, and he had to move out, and he thought, wouldn't it be brilliant to stage some gigs in this toilet and just invite two or three onlookers.
I saw photos of people watching from, was it like a flat roof outside the window?
Yeah, so just outside one of the rooms, he had a big flat roof, and so people could watch, because he sort of designed it so there'd be, I mean, I think it was about 9 acts that day that were all performing in this tiny toilet.
Sounds like a place to be.
And each act had a private audience of 3. So people were turning up, 3 different people each time. So people were sort of turning up at the designated times, but they were just, because it was such a lovely day and everybody could get out onto this roof, people just hung out. It was so cool. But and I recorded that on a 4-track with 2 SM58s kind of dangling as close, you know, kind of dangling wherever I could kind of tape them, really, because there was hardly any room in there. And actually, we've got that for a release. That's another release we'll be getting out this year. It was so much fun. And you know, you know, why not? You know?
who ended up playing?
We had Deej from Thought Forms with Sarah on visuals. They were called Rainbow Yawn. We had Tremolo Ghosts. Dan did a 3 drummer improv thing with Kit McKenzie and Lauertim. Who else did we have? We had Harpoon did a sort of electronic set on the floor. DM Withers did a collaboration with a couple of people. I think it was with Aaron and someone from the Liquid Library Collective. Yeah, there was quite a few people on that day. There was Robert Ridley Shackleton did an absolute blinder as well. It was really good. Yeah, it was brilliant. We did a Toilet Fest 2 actually a few weeks later as well, because it was so much fun. Oh, gone are the days.
Oh. Lament. You mentioned Put Out. Is that on your label? You have a label, am I right to say that? Is it called Crystal
Fuzz? I do.
Fuzz?
I mean, it's a label, but it's mainly to put my own stuff out on. It's not really a sort of, you know, active kind of thing. But yes, Crystal Fuzz Records. I put all my stuff out on that. And I'll put Toilet Fest out on that. Mm. We've got the tapes. We just got to get the zine together and then we can put that out.
Nice.
Very nice.
Going back to Secret Saturdays, so obviously I was involved in one of those, and I didn't actually go to any of the others. That's like a proper, like, that's a terrible local musician's thing to do, isn't it? Where you just go to the one you do. Who else played those? Because you had like bands in there, didn't you? Like
full-on
bands.
We did. We had Memory of Elephants in there. Did an absolute sweaty blinder in there. It was absolutely fantastic, which I've still got ready to go out at some point. I just have to talk to them about it. MXLX did a completely ridiculous total noise jam with a guitar on its back and a cymbal. So he was just kind of playing it with the cymbal, but the noise was glorious. And he just did the sort of 20 minutes of like, and the only in the way he can. Run Logan Run did a shot in there. That was awesome.
Was that when Dan was playing with them?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So that was early Run Logan Run, really. Yeah, it was fantastic. Oh, Andy's saxophone playing. It's breathtaking. I'm not sure who else we had in there. Oh, well, Hysterical Injury did one, of course, as well. That was one of my favorite ones, I think.
So how were you recording them? Was that a bit more traditional? That just wasn't a couple of mics up, was it? That was a bit more decent, or was it?
Well, depending on what we had, it would either be DIs and mics, or I mean, I go with the Glyn Johns thing a lot, like. I always think in threes or fives. So the Glyn Johns drum miking technique has served me well for so long. So I kind of like would think of that in terms of just a room space. So the condenser mic would take up the room sound and I'd find a sweet spot for that. And then maybe get some close mics in on some other things for detail. But the condenser I used was the Sontronics Helios, which has just been a fantastic mic. It's kind of like a cut down version of a Neumann, but it's such a great workhorse. It works on drums, it works on bass, guitars, vocals. So that always that mic in the room would just get most of the presence, and then a couple of mics then, usually 58s for detail, or the Alesis Floor kick drum mic.
The Sontronics stuff is glorious, absolutely.
Yeah.
I've got an Apollo.
And that's brilliant on bass amps as well.
Just a really unusual, slightly different character to everything else. It's great.
Mm. Yeah, so often that would be my choice. And I did have I've got a drum mic kit of Alesis drum mics. So often I'd have that with me just in case I needed any extra stuff. So if I needed close mic snares or stuff like that, I'd put a couple of those. And at the time I would have been using a Focusrite Sapphire,
classic.
Which I bought secondhand off a friend at BIM. It was just easier to carry around than the Alesis Fire FireWire mix thing I had. I think that's what it's called.
The IO 26 or whatever it was. I had
that
was good.
Which was
as
a
well.
Great thing.
It was great.
It was a great thing.
The drivers had just drop.
I really loved it.
Yeah, I loved it. It was brilliant. ADATs as well.
Mm.
Yeah. So
things like that. And yeah, I mean, it was definitely not expensive gear, but I just knew how it worked to get a clear sound from every signal, and then I could kind of build a picture afterwards. And again, all my thing was like, is to try and get it clear, a nice clear signal at the source, enough of its character or as much of its character as I could get, and then blend it at the other end when I sort of pack up and go off. And that was generally my setup, was that Focusrite, the drum mics, my Helios, and my laptop with Logic 9 in it.
Classic, nice. Indeed, yeah.
My chain these days is... So I'm not doing so much site stuff, obviously, but I hadn't done any site stuff probably since I recorded EP64 and Bellies for their vinyl release that they did in 2019.
Oh, cool. I didn't know you'd done that. That's
yeah.
Amazing.
That was fantastic, yeah. And I'm very proud to sort of say it's the only serious kind of recording that EP64 have done, and they're only doing 64 shows and they're on 57, so I feel very honored to be part of that in that way.
I was going to say, for the benefit of our listeners, who and what is EP64?
Just one of the most incredible bands I've seen in a really long time. I think I've seen 50 out of those 57 gigs. They improvise live. Dali de St. Paul, it's her band, and she plays mainly with Dan Johnson on drums, but various other drums like Jesse Webb from Big Naturals. And they've collaborated with Ben Vince, Ossia, Silver Waves. And basically they do between 30 and 45 minute sets, completely improvised. And it's just a spectacular, they are brilliant improvisers. It's spectacular, incredible energy. And the band is called Ephemeral Project, EP64. Came to Dali in a dream where she was going to form this improvisational band that were going to do 64 gigs and then disappear. And so they're on 57 right now.
I can't big up that concept.
They'd be finished by now.
They would be finished by now. And in fact, one of the last shows I went to was a show that they did in the police station in Bristol. And it was just, with Ben Vince, unreal. You know, it was like proper rave days of the 90s. It was fantastic. Anyway, but my signal chain now, as I'm mostly static, is this mic into a Universal Audio Solo 610, into Fireface interface, RME, into Logic X.
That's a lovely, lovely process. 57, yeah. SM7, sorry, there, is that, yeah.
7B, yeah.
7B, very pleasant indeed.
Yeah.
And is that the whole of so you've been doing the cellos and things like that?
I did do some cellos on that album, but my friend who, I mean, I'm not a very good cello player, so I'd written quite a few cello bits and tried to sort of do it myself. And even though the sound was all right, the playing was absolutely awful. So I was working with a friend, Drew Morgan, who is a composer. He composed Halo 4, the game, the music for that.
Oh, cool.
And works with Neil Davidge a lot on TV stuff, and he's an absolutely fantastic composer, producer, and friend, really good friend. And I asked him if he would like to do the cellos and the arrangements and play them, and he did from his studio, which is just like two streets away.
Yeah, I guess because you mentioned you're really close to J&J. I mean, I guess it's kind of that area of Bristol has got. I mean, there's so much creative stuff going on, isn't there, I guess, in that square mile.
Yeah, I love it here. It's really nice, and it was funny to be working with Drew like that, but not being able to see him, even though he was a few streets away, you know.
Like shouting directions out the window. Like,
yeah, love it, Drew.
It's a B-flat.
Yeah. But he just recorded it in his space and then just sent the bounces out. And then Billy Fuller, Beaks, one of the beat guys, he did the upright bass on four of the tracks in his place in Bristol, or just outside Bristol. And Joe Kelly, who lived on the same road as me, they did two of the upright bass things.
It's incredibly coherent sounding record, considering I didn't realise how sort of fractured the recording and stuff had been. It's really coherent sounding thing. It's great. What's it called?
It's called Bloodletting.
There you go, a bit of a plug there.
Yeah.
When's it out?
I'm hoping for a spring release. So as soon as I got test pressings and all that back, I'll be able to be a bit firmer with the date.
What's your role working with the Penelopes? I mean, I must admit it's a part of your work that I don't really know much about at all.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Well, I'm a songwriter with them, basically. I do the lyrics and the melodies, and it's sort of track and hook vibe. So they'll produce a track and they'll go, Annie, can you try this? And I'll give them a melody and some lyrics, and then it'll go back and forth like that. And I think because they're French speaking and they're... you know, even though their English is fantastic, I think they need, you know, an English person to sort of make the lyrics for them. And we've just been working for a very long time together now, probably since 2012. I started out playing bass for them live and singing for them live.
Oh, I was going to ask how the collaboration came about.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I was singing. Well, I was actually hired in. So we met. Well, it's a long story. Hysterical Injury were playing the 10-year anniversary of Ladyfest in London at the Garage. And we met another performer there called She Makes War, Laura Kidd. And she really liked us. And she was working with the Penelopes, but she couldn't keep up all of the session work she was doing. So she recommended me and my brother on the drums. So we got to know them. I was sort of depping really for her at the time, but there was quite a lot of things she couldn't do, so I ended up doing more and more, and then we all fell out and it was terrible, but I stayed with them. So
bands, eh?
Bands.
That again, eh?
But the Penelopes and I have stayed together, and I stopped sort of doing the live stuff with them sort of 2017. I think the last gig I did with them was at Razzmatazz in Barcelona. It was amazing. It was so amazing. But since all that time, we've been writing together. All of their sort of most recent releases are stuff I've written or done vocal arrangements for or ghost sung for, that kind of thing. We've got some really exciting things coming up. Hopefully we'll be out this year as well. And that's an ongoing job. I mean, I talk to them every day. I'm always doing something with them.
That's amazing. Like, what an excellent kind of... Yeah, I don't know when you sleep, I mean, to be honest.
Yeah, it sounds amazing, doesn't it? It's like, honestly, I spend my time going, I don't do anything.
I think the busiest...
I'm not doing enough.
The busiest people do. I think it's a really, I think it's a common thing to just like constantly feel like you're not achieving as much as you should.
Yeah, not being productive enough or...
Yeah.
It's weird, isn't it? It's weird.
Until someone makes you listen.
Totally unnecessary.
A podcast and someone makes you talk about it for an hour and then you realise there's quite a lot, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's brilliant. Thanks so much, Annie, for chatting to us about it. It's been really, really fascinating and amazing, and I can't wait for people to hear your album, because I've been in the privileged position to be able to listen to it many times now, and it is, it is absolutely excellent.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's been thank you for having me on. It's brilliant to be able to talk about recording and sound and engineering and all that stuff. It's not something I usually get asked about, so it's really great to talk about it and think about it, and so thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thank you ever so much.
Cool. Let's call it a day.
Let's call it a day.
Fab.
Thanks, everyone. I hope you have a lovely tea time.
Yeah.
Okay, let's do it. 3, 2, 1. Bye, everyone.
Bye.